You are listening to Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. For the next few minutes, you'll discover what's been around us all the time, the rich history of the American Civil War, and how you can experience that history for yourself at the American Civil War Museum. S. Waite Rawls III is the co-chief executive officer of the American Civil War Museum. He's with me in the studio. Waite, many people have heard of the museum and the White House of the Confederacy, but what has changed?
Lou, the longtime Richmond folks know the Museum of the Confederacy and the White House of the Confederacy. They were started in 1890 by a group of women. I always say that if you've got hard work to do, get men to do it. But if the work is really hard, you'd better get women to do it. And there were no men on our board until 1991. So 101 years of being run entirely by women. But they started by saving the White House of the Confederacy and naming it the White House of the Confederacy. It had been called the Executive Mansion during the war. And for 20 years, it was used as a schoolhouse by the Richmond Central Schools. The kids tore the place apart, and they were going to tear it down to build a new schoolhouse. So a group of women started the museum in 1890 and to basically save the White House of the Confederacy from being torn down. They started calling it the White House. It's never been painted white. They thought it sounded more important if it was the White House. And they turned it into a museum. And it stayed as a museum until 1976. Those of us who are my age or older remember going in the museum when it was in the White House itself. And it was the 1980s when they restored the White House and built a new museum building in 1976 right next door to it. At that time, MCV was still relatively small. It was a small teaching hospital. The museum was built slightly smaller than the White House because they wanted to give the honor of the biggest building in the neighborhood to be the White House of the Confederacy. So the museum itself was moved into that new building in 1976. The White House was restored to its wartime appearance and reopened in 1988. Is a fully restored house. In the interim, it had been named a National Historic Landmark. When they started that program nationally, there were only 50 named in the country, and the three named in Virginia were Monticello and Mount Vernon and the White House of the Confederacy. Since then, we've seen just an explosion of MCV into VCU Hospital, so we're now swamped with high-rise buildings on all sides. But the Museum of the Confederacy combined in 2013 with the American Civil War Center at Historic Tredegar. And we became and renamed ourselves the American Civil War Museum. We'll have three locations down the road. One location is our new facility out in Appomattox that was built in 2012. One facility will be the White House of the Confederacy, which will continue to be run there on its historic site. And then the museum will move to new facilities down at the site of the Tredegar Iron Works. Now, that's going to be under construction over the next couple of years and open to the public in 2017 or 18. We're all really excited about that because it'll be a fabulous new facility.
Lately, there's been a lot of controversy, but you have stayed away from controversy. You show the historical artifacts of that era, of the 4 years.
Well, one of the great compliments that we've ever gotten came from no less than the New York Times. As the controversy about the Confederate flag peaked in late June and early July after the tragedy in Charleston, the New York Times contacted us and said they had done quite a bit of research to discover that there was a relevant museum backed with serious scholarship. Well, I cannot think of any better compliment than that. So they put a big article about the museum on the front page of the New York Times above the fold. And we're quite complimentary about the fact that we raise, I like to say that we are passionate about our dispassion. Be intellectually honest. Raise it above the anger that seems to surround so many people today on so many issues, and simply be an educational institution that helps inform people of not what to think, but how to think things through.
I want to go into depth on what you have available to show and what people will see if they go in there, or an audio tour of what they can see. But you spoke a little while back to a group I'm a member of, and you mentioned that people frequently call and say, do you have Confederate flags for sale? And you gave a delightful answer.
Well, it was a wonderful instance. People don't understand the flags of the era. The normal Northern unit carried very standardized two flags, a stars and stripes and a regimental flag, which was standardized. Confederates carried any doggone old flag they wanted to carry. So the Confederate nation had three flags, the first, second, and third national flag, as they're called. But for battle flags, it was anything they wanted to carry. Robert E. Lee tried to standardize one pattern for his army, but it never was completely standardized. A lot of guys carried that. But other units carried other flags. So we get a call from somebody who says he's from California, and he wants to know if we sell Confederate flags. And we said, yes, we do. And the standard answer that we give is, which one? And he said, what do you mean, which one? I've got a Confederate ancestor. I want to honor my Confederate ancestor. And we said, well, what do you know about him? And he said, well, he was from Alabama. And we said, well, that's a good start. Do you know where he fought or who he fought with? And he said, well, yes, he fought in Tennessee and Mississippi and Georgia. And he thinks that he fought with somebody named Cleburne. And we said, oh, you mean Claiborne? He said, yes, that's the guy. He fought with Claiborne. I want a Confederate flag to honor my ancestor. And we said, well, you need a Hardee pattern flag. And he said, well, what's that? And we said, well, it's a big blue flag with a white polka dot in the middle of it. He said, what? He said, yeah, well, that was the second most common Confederate battle flag used during the war. And Claiborne and his commander, William Hardee, were both Irish. So their flag had a reference to the Irish full moon revolution of 1798. Long silence on the phone. And he goes, describe it again. Well, it's a blue flag with a white polka dot. Long silence. And he said, yeah, what the heck? Send me one of those things. So, but we love to say which one when somebody says something about the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag, its history did not stop in 1865. That's the important thing. It continues, or they continue to make history up through this summer. They continue to make history. Now, what so many people think of is the Confederate flag, which is a rectangular red flag with a blue cross and white stars and no border around the outside of it, was seldomly used during the war. Some units in Tennessee used it. Some naval ships used it. But it was became, during the Civil Rights era, the standard flag of the massive resistance or white supremacy or no integration people. So it became known in the 1960s as the Confederate flag, as if there was no other.
So you're saying it really was one of many, and probably many hundred.
Well, we've got 12 flags, for instance, in our collection that were made from women's wedding dresses. The most patriotic thing a guy could do was volunteer and go in the Army. Well, the most patriotic thing a woman could do was take her most valued possession, which was her wedding dress, rip it up and re-sew it into a flag that her husband's unit would then carry into battle. One of them is a beautiful flag that simply says it's a white flag with some blue stars around it, and it simply says home. And that says so much about what the men in that unit were fighting for. We've got other wonderful flags with painted symbols on them. The men from Powhatan County had a flag that said that they were the guard of the daughters of Powhatan. Well, who was Powhatan's daughter? It was Pocahontas. So Pocahontas was painted on their flag. That's the flag they carried in the battle. A group of men from Caroline County carried a flag into battle where they all stood in ranks and the artist painted the men on their flag. Several of them are recognizable from photographs and things.
So the flag that many people today, since the 1960s, the Stars and Bars, which unit carried that?
Well, let me correct you. The Stars and Bars was the national flag, and that is a blue canton like the U.S. flag with a circle of stars, but then a red bar and a white bar and a red bar. That's why it's the Stars and Bars. Many people call the red one with the blue cross on it, the sideways cross, they call that the Stars and Bars, but that's not correct. Let me tell you how it was designed, by the way. The original design came about after the First Battle of Manassas. Joe Johnston, who was the Confederate commander, noted that with the wind not blowing, the Stars and Stripes and the Stars and Bars look like the same flag, and the wrong guys start shooting at the wrong guys. So he goes back to the Confederate Congress, and he says, we need a different flag to use in battle. So Congress designed one. They came up with a blue flag with an upright red St. George's cross with white stars on it. It immediately ran into strenuous objections because it was too Christian. And we have to remember that Jewish people were very prominent and very powerful in the South, more so than in the North in 1860. And they said, that's too Christian. Let's do something different. To satisfy them, and particularly an outspoken synagogue in Charleston, they came up with a square flag, and they put an X on it. And they did not call it a St. Andrew's cross. They called it a saltier, which is the word from heraldry for an X on a flag. So the Confederate Congress designed the flag with the approval of the synagogue in Charleston that this thing was not too Christian. And that became a very prominent flag for the Army of Northern Virginia. And it's called the Army of Northern Virginia pattern. That became Lee's army, but it was never fully standardized, even in his army.
You're hearing from Waite Rawls, who is the co-chief executive officer of the American Civil War Museum. Waite, I know a lot is under construction, but what is in the collection that people either can see now or will be able to see? Authentic stuff.
Yeah, Lou, the thing that distinguishes us from every other Civil War museum is the collection. Not only is it far larger and far more prominent. I mean, if you want to see Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, Jeb Stuart, Wade Hampton, you name your famous Confederate, his stuff is there. Likewise, over half of the collection is not military. That women's dresses, children's dolls, all sorts of things, slave-made items that were used on the home front fill the collection. When people come in, you can tell the guys gravitate to the military stuff and the gals gravitate to the non-military stuff. The gals tend to love the interior decoration of the White House or some of the dresses. We've got a dress that's mounted on display now that drives women nutty because the gal would have been about 6'2", and she had a 19-inch waist. And women look at that and go, oh, my goodness, how could anybody fit in that? But we've got all sorts of things. As the war went on, people had to live at home. So we've got children's school books, the math book. You know, all of us remember doing the multiplication table. Well, this one, the multiplication table says, if one Confederate can kill 10 Yankees, how many Yankees can 9 Confederates kill? So this is how the kids were doing their multiplication tables. We've got mourning clothes. We mourn the dead today, but there was a ritual in the 1860s of mourning where the women wore black, and they wore black for extended periods of time with black veils. And in Richmond during the war, you would have seen hundreds, if not thousands, of women on the streets dressed in black. Well, we've got those dresses on display. Now, after a certain specified period of time, you could come out of mourning and go to half mourning, which meant you wore drab colored dresses, and we've got one of them on display. We had a visitor come and say, okay, now which half of the morning would she wear that dress? We said, no, you missed the meaning here. She's in mourning, but only she's working her way out of mourning. All of the famous Confederates, the Robert E. Lee's son, when the museum started, his wife was dead, and he, of course, was dead, so his son donated all of his things. Jeb Stuart's widow, Stonewall Jackson's widow, Jefferson Davis's widow donated all of their things. But it was also common for the private soldier to come in and donate his uniform, his shoes. We've got hunks of chewing tobacco. We've got pieces of hardtack, which was the hard biscuit that they... Now, I don't know why in the world you would save a piece of hardtack to have it available to donate it to the museum, but they did.
It seemed interesting to me, and perhaps to our listeners, that at that time they wanted to preserve what they had done, so they donated it to a museum.
That is exactly the feeling that so many of the donors had. They kept stuff, or at least the white people kept stuff. One of the great problems with all museums, ours included, is things from African Americans, because they could barely keep themselves alive, much less have a trunk in the attic filled with old things. But they kept stuff. And then when they donated it, and again, the museum started only 25 years after the war ended. When they donated it, you can imagine the 25-year-old is now 50 years old. The 40-year-old is now 65 years old. They are worried about whether or not future generations will remember what they did, the sacrifices they made, the hardships that they suffered through. And so they wanted to donate their things so that future generations could see, could hear, could perhaps understand what their generation had done.
Unlike perhaps many other museums, and I don't want to put down any other museum, but the things that you have on display are authentic. You were telling me, and I want you to share with our listeners, how you know that they are authentic.
Well, some of the stories and documentation, I love to show people Wade Hampton's sword. Now, Wade Hampton was a famous Confederate. He ended up being the governor of South Carolina after the war. He donated his sword, and you say, how do you know it's his sword? Well, here's a letter from Wade Hampton saying, here's my sword. But one of my favorite things in the collection, another South Carolinian, Wade Hampton was from South Carolina, was Ellison Capers, who by the 1890s was the Episcopal Bishop of South Carolina. And Wade Hampton's daughter went to him and said, not Bishop Capers, but General Capers, we want your things for the museum in Richmond. And he said, no, I think I'll hang on to it for a while. And she said, no, you don't understand. My father and Lee's family and Stewart's family and Jackson's family and Davis's family have donated their things, so we want your things. And he said, no, I'm going to keep them. And she said, you really don't understand. We here in South Carolina would not want things from Georgia or North Carolina to be better than from South Carolina in that museum. Now give me your stuff. And with that, he was convinced, and he said, do you want my uniform? Yep. Overcoat? Yep. Sword? Yep. So as she's leaving, he reached in his pants pocket and pulled out a small purse with a clasp on it, opened it up, and shook out a mangled bullet. And he said, they pulled this out of my leg at Chickamauga. and I've carried it in my pants pocket ever since. You don't want that, do you? And she said, yes, indeed, I'll take it, and give me the purse also. So we've got both of them in the collection. And it says something about how the collection came into place. Over half of it was there by 1905, and so the stories were still fresh in the minds of many of the people.
Wait, Rawls, tell us, if you will, what is the theme or themes of the museum? What you want people to understand as they walk away?
We want them to understand a little bit of history the way you would hear it in school. There was a beginning of a war and why, and there was a middle of a war and what was it like, and there was an end of a war and how did that happen. But what we also want them to understand is these were people. And what were the people like? What were they thinking? What were they doing? So frequently, instead of just a uniform and say, here's a nice uniform and it's gray and it's got gold trim on it, you put a picture of the guy wearing the uniform next to the uniform, and you tell a story about the guy so that you understand the people a little bit better. And this is particularly valuable when the people are not the rich and famous, if you will, but the common everyday people. The stories that go along with these artifacts are so good. One of my favorite artifacts is a plate, and it looks like a plate. And if you look carefully, you'll see there's a crack in it. Well, it was donated by a woman from Luray, Virginia, and she said that the Yankees had come into her house and they were stealing everything, and she took that plate and whacked one of them in the head with it, and he dropped to the floor, and his comrades wanted to take advantage of her until an officer came in and broke it up. And she said the only memory she had was that hard-headed Yankee had cracked her plate. So the artifact itself is next to nothing, but the story that goes with the artifact is the thing that people go, okay, now I can imagine what it would be like to be a woman alone in a house where a bunch of rough guys come in stealing everything, and you're trying to defend yourself. And you whack one of them in the head with the plate. And now I'm looking at the plate.
You have many things on display. There has been the Museum and White House of the Confederacy, now the American Civil War Museum. But talk a little bit about one of the new facilities that you established in Appomattox, not far from the McLean House.
Our new facility in Appomattox was opened in the spring of 2012. We wanted, it's hard for people to get to us there on Clay Street, swamped by VCU. So our saying was, let's take the museum to the people. And so we examined, where do people go? Well, Appomattox is one of the places. And the end of our Civil War is an amazing story in world history. Other Civil Wars end with the losers going to the guillotine or the hangman's noose. And in our case, the losers simply went home with a promise not to fight anymore. And it stands alone in world history that way. So we opened a facility in Appomattox. There we tried very hard to personalize almost everything that's on display. So almost everything starts with a photograph of the man or woman, the man who was writing the letter or the woman who was getting the letter. The woman who wore the dress, the man who wore the uniform or carried the pistol. And we say something, how old was he? Where was he from? Did he have an education or not? As a VMI guy, I'm proud of the fact that 11 of them went to VMI. And we made sure, as a VMI guy, I made sure that it was on the exhibit label for each one of those. Now, at the end of that major exhibit in Appomattox, we talked about going home. What did people do at the end of the war? Well, refugees would go home if their home was still there. The soldiers would go home, and sometimes they would find the home was not still there. Sometimes they would find it is. We hear a lot about post-traumatic stress syndrome today and heard nothing about it then. But the instances of guys going home, kissing their wife, and then moving to California to become a gold miner or a hermit. Or one of my favorites, a couple of Confederate generals moved to Egypt and became generals in the Egyptian army. Now, one of the intriguing stories is, if you were a slave, what does the whole concept of going home mean? What is home? Is home living in the same cabin, sleeping in the same bed, wearing the same clothes, eating the same food, and doing the same job? Okay, now, for a lot of African-American slaves, that's what happened at the end of the war, is home was that same cabin with that same job, but as the saying went, they cannot sell us now. And so the big difference was nothing to do with your everyday life, but you did not have the fear of being sold and split up with your family.
Wait, Rawls, you've given us a wonderful description of what you have on display and why. But when people go there, they're not going to have the advantage of talking to you personally, necessarily. What type of explanation, you've given a great explanation, but what type of explanation do people get at the museum?
Well, there are two things, Lou. The one is there are audio wands that are available that you can carry the audio wand around with you and hear some of these descriptions. But then again, the exhibit labels, this is what the exhibit labels are all about. Now, for those of your listeners who are visually impaired, get somebody to go with you so that you can see what you can see, but then you can have that person with you, accompanying you, and explaining what is in that case.
Wade Rawls is the co-chief executive officer of the American Civil War Museum. Where is the museum for those who have yet to be there?
It's at 1201 East Clay Street. Now, that is right next to the emergency room for VCU Hospital. So if you can GPS it, do so. If you can follow a map, do so. If you can follow the signs that say emergency room for the hospital this way, do that. There's parking that's free in the adjoining, it's the hospital parking deck. Bring your parking pass in. We'll stamp it so it's your parking is free. So it's convenient parking.
S. Wade Rawls III is the co-chief executive officer of the American Civil War Museum, and he has joined us in the studio with a great description. You might want to take advantage of what you will see there. You're listening to Discovering Virginia on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.